Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
So we're going to be talking about tonight is going to be mostly the flood and the fossil record, but I always like to try to set the tone for the class and, you know, why we're talking about, you know, what we're talking about. And so a few verses. First of all, always be prepared to give a defense. I know everyone is familiar with this scripture, but 1 Peter 3, 13 through 15, and who is he who will harm you if you become followers of what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. And do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. And so even if if someone's, you know, kind of being, you know, I'll just say like a little bit hostile or something, asking you, well, you know, how can you be a Christian, or how can you this or that? Well, we're supposed to be obviously prepared to give the defense. But then we also, when we are giving our defense, we want to be really gentle about it. You know, it says, you know, meekness and fear, because that's, if someone go to the extreme, but if someone's, again, just kind of hostile, maybe sharp tone of voice, you know, asking you about Christianity, ask you, well, how can you guys believe that? Or do you really believe this? If we respond equally hostile, we might win the argument, but it's not going to do them any good for eternity. I mean, it's not really accomplishing the goal. And so again, be prepared to give a defense. Know what we'd say in really any situation. Of course, this quarter we're talking about Christian evidences, but it's on any topic. And that's where you just never know what you might get hit with. So we all want to try to be as prepared as possible on all related topics. But again, it is important how we respond, it's most important how we respond from a standpoint of the tone we use. And then the content, if we feel like, oh, I should have said this, I should have said that, we follow up later. And so just always try to keep that tone of gentleness. Ephesians 4, 14 through 15, related, speak the truth in love. As a result, we are no longer to be children, tossed here and there by waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness and deceitful scheming. But speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in all aspects into him who is the head, even Christ. And so, speaking the truth in love, and it goes along with what we were saying with the last set of verses. But, it can be hard to speak the truth in love. I mean, am I the only one that struggles with that? Yeah. I mean, it can be hard. So, another verse to remember on that is our struggle is not against people. And so if we're talking with someone, just recognize if they're opposing the Bible, if they're opposing Christianity, if they've put their faith in atheism, they're not our enemy. They've just been deceived by our enemy. And that's a true statement. And so if we look at a person that way, it makes it a lot easier, again, to look at the basically to speak the truth in love. In other words, they're not the enemy, they're a victim of our enemy, might be another way to phrase it. Ephesians 6, 11 through 12, put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. So two views of the fossil record. I'm going to start out with that. One, of course, is it shows evolution, and the other is it shows Genesis 1 through 11. And so from the evolution standpoint, again, this is just a summary, but I think a lot of you are familiar with the evolutionary perspective on the fossil record. Fossils were formed over hundreds of millions of years, and the order of burial is related to time. So in other words, fossils that are buried lower in the fossil record, well, they evolved, say, earlier or sooner, and then you move up and say the fossils that are buried up here, they were, supposedly evolved later in time. And then when you point out things like, a lot of times fossils will show up just all of a sudden in the fossil record, like always, the basic kind of animal. and then they stay essentially the same through the whole fossil record. And that's tacitly acknowledged in things like you'll watch, say, a National Geographic special. A lot of times they'll say things like, oh, you know, sharks have remained unchanged for 400 million years. So that's why they're spinning it. But what they really mean is sharks show up here in the fossil record. Using the assumptions they use on the dating methods, they'll say, oh, it's 400 million years till you get up to here, and they're all the same. So rather than saying it that way, they'll phrase it the other way. And of course, and so that's basically what they're acknowledging also, is there is this lack of transitional forms. I mean, something just shows up, that basic kind stays the same within that basic kind, goes away. And so usually that's explained away either imperfections in the fossil record, although, you know, we've studied the fossil record a lot, or a punctuated equilibrium. That was popularized, I think it was maybe Stephen Jay Gould popularized that a lot in the 70s, just that things stay the same and then they just evolve really fast and then they stay the same. And so there's no time for those forms to basically arise. Now, from a biblical, chance for us to find those transitional forms because they were just so short-lived, you know, because there's this really rapid transition from one form to another. Biblical creation, typically it's fossils formed primarily during the flood. In this case, though, the order of burial is related to the order the habitats were destroyed. So you see fountains of the great deep, you're reading through Genesis, the marine habitats are destroyed first. And so you see marine habitats buried earliest in the fossil record, but you also are having huge tsunamis. I mean, the flood is an extremely violent event, so you get some of those marine fossils are washing up on land. I mean, it's through the violence of the flood. The order of burial, again, so it's related to the order the habitats were destroyed, but also animals have the ability to flee rising floodwaters and other factors would affect when they are buried. One of the things that's interesting, there's a lot of dinosaurs, you'll find their tracks, say here in the sediment, and you don't find any bones of the animal until here. Okay, and so the idea, you know, explanation, and I gotta stress that, because, you know, what we know is what the Bible tells us, but that's very consistent with this idea that, yeah, animals were basically fleeing the rising floodwaters. They were walking, but before they actually got buried, you know, probably just by a, you know, mudslide or something in very violent event, their tracks are fossilized here. It's hard to fossilize tracks. Tracks are fossilized here. Animal itself's not up here. But by some methods, they might say, oh, there's millions of years. Well, why would you have millions of years from when you're seeing the tracks of an animal before you start finding the bones? So again, it's more, I'd say, consistent with the biblical account. The transitional forms never existed, and so that's the explanation for why you don't find transitional forms. And then the quality of fossils also indicates rapid burial and fossilization, and that's one that's changed a lot, I'd say, the last few decades. Now, pretty much everyone's acknowledging that fossils are formed and they're buried very rapidly. It was some kind of catastrophic event when the fossils were formed. Now, that catastrophic event, if you're a Christian, hey, that can be the flood. If for people outside Christianity or don't, for whatever reason, are opposed to Christianity, say, well, no, can't, you know, catastrophic event, it just can't be a global flood, even though the global flood works really well. And so that's, again, just the quality of fossils you see in some of these pictures. I mean, there's fish that are buried. You can see the gill slits on the fish. You can see eyes. You can see, you know, things that, again, has to be preserved very rapidly. And so it's, again, the general consensus that you're seeing something that was buried quite rapidly. And of course, other things, we'll talk a little bit about geology at some point, but you look at the Grand Canyon, you look at the strata, you look at the strata that's laid down, you don't see erosion between the layers of strata. And so again, indicating that those strata were laid down very rapidly together. But a great analogy is Mount St. Helens, because it's very, very analogous what you see happened at Mount St. Helens. It's a really tiny flood, just basically caused by the glaciers melting when that volcano erupted. But you see the same types of effects that you see on a much larger scale. So, and even now, starting to be agreement that the Grand Canyon was caused by a flood. Again, it's okay to say that now. It wasn't 100 years ago. It's okay to say it's caused by this huge flood, as long as, again, it wasn't the flood of the Bible, the flood that's talked about in Genesis. And so I'm going to just give some examples related to transitional forms, because you see this a lot. And so with evolution, what a transitional form is just saying, well, maybe this kind of animal turned into this kind of animal. So they used to have, uh, not the Smithsonian, I'll just say, keeps getting updated, and to its credit, it seems to be being updated in the right direction. You know, we talk about science catching up with the Bible. So they used to have like what they call the horse series, and they'd line up these horses and little horses, you know, somehow evolving into big horses. Well, we knew that was wrong since I think the 20s, but it was in there probably through the 70s or 80s. But this idea is just basically, did that horse really evolve, or was it just variation within the horse kind? In other words, when God created the original horse kind, did the two, or the horses, have the genetic information needed to have small horses, big horses? And of course, now all of our understanding of DNA is, yeah, it's very easy for even, you know, two horses coming off of the ark to have all of the genetic information needed for all the different types of horses we see today. We know that for sure on breeds of dogs, because most of them have been bred in the last 300 or 400 years. So we talked about that a little bit towards the end last week, but it's all about the genetic information. And so that's why the variation within the kind is, I would say, gaining more and more acceptance, because we're starting to realize just how much information can be in the DNA of a single male and a single female. Even Adam and Eve, we talked about that last week. Even people opposed to Christianity refer to mitochondrial Eve, Y chromosome Adam, because the evidence is saying, hey, we all trace back to a single man, single woman. Now, they'll throw out an age of, say, 180,000 years ago, which that's based on assumptions. Basically, we're assuming we evolved from apes, and so therefore, how long ago would that common ancestor be? If you do measured mutations rates, better science, in other words, rates, because you can say mitochondrial DNA, well, you can check the great-grandmother, the grandmother, the mother, and the daughter, right? You measure the change rate, well, that's totally consistent with 6,000 years. And so it's just, if you assume that, wow, he had to have all these changes going from apes to people. So again, that's another one, but just the fact that people are now acknowledging that, hey, it looks like we all came from a single man, single woman. We know for sure that all of the physical characteristics of all the people on Earth today could, the information, the genetic information needed for that could be easily in the DNA of a single man, a single woman. So again, that's the variation in the kind. It's not that one kind of animal is evolving into another. It's just variation within the kind. So that's kind of the difference. And it's really important. We'll talk about a lot of the racist philosophies that really started out with Charles Darwin and got promoted heavily in Europe and the U.S. was by racist philosophies that pretended racism was scientific, because they would literally say things like, well, you know, some races are, you know, aren't as evolved as other races. And we got the quotes, you know, in their books. I got copies of the books. Some of these quotes are so outlandish. You're like, did they really say that? And, you know, you got published books. Yeah, they said it. We even taught it in U.S. biology classes. So there's a lot of implications here between these two. Is one kind of animal really evolving to another, or is it just variation within a kind? And so I used kind of a trivial example here just to visualize. If we didn't have dogs today and all we found were bones, and you found a Yorkie and a Beagle and a German Shepherd, you know, you could make arguments either way. Either, well, those are all dogs, it's just variation within a kind of dog, or maybe the Yorkies, you know, evolved into the Beagle, which evolved into the German Shepherd. So that's maybe, again, just to try to visualize the debate here. So this is the paradigm that one chooses is what you'll start to see that really can affect how evidence is interpreted. So if someone found dog bones and they really wanted to say, hey, I think Yorkies turned into Beagles, turned into German Shepherds, they could call that the dog series. Well, they can interpret them one way. And then just like bone chips, bone fragments, it's really hard to debate that, because very subjective. It's not scientific. That's why our studies of DNA, other things where you are actually in the lab, you're actually looking at what's going on, they're actually much more scientific than just this, well, that could maybe have done this or maybe have done that. But the idea that a person's, you could call it a paradigm, affects how they interpret data, that's actually a lot of people acknowledge that. This was David Pilbeam. So he's a paleoanthropologist, PhD, Yale University. You know, he's a professor at Harvard University. It's an older quote, but he says, I'm also aware of the fact that, at least in my own subject of paleoanthropology, theory, heavily influenced by implicit ideas, almost always dominates data. Okay? So the theory is dominating the data. Now, it's not that people are necessarily overriding the data, there's just not a lot of data. And the data that there is very subjective. Again, a lot of times it's just bone fragments or you know, very limited portions of a fossil. Ideas that are totally unrelated to actual fossils have dominated theory building, which in turn strongly influenced the way fossils are interpreted. Now, on the idea of transitional forms, people also readily acknowledge there aren't any transitional forms. This was Colin Patterson. He's a senior paleontologist, British Museum of Natural History. He wrote a book about evolution, but he didn't show transitional forms. And so the publisher was saying, hey, you got to put some transitional forms in here. And so this was his quote. He said, I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. You suggest that an artist should be used to visualize such transformations, but where would he get the information from? I could honestly provide it, and if I were to leave it to artistic license, would that not mislead the reader? Okay, so that's really straightforward. Now, unfortunately, you go to almost every biology textbook today, it's got the artists, you know, saying that they had fossils here, they had fossils here, and you got all these, you know, probably 10 transitions in between, and that was even 10 years ago. Now with AI, you can probably make them really look real. At least 10 years ago, you could still look in the footnote and it would say, well, yeah, we actually found this and we found this, and all this was just a reasonable artistic interpretation of how this transitioned into this. I'm not sure if the footnote's there anymore. So I'm gonna try to get a hold of like a 2026 biology textbook and see if they, because a lot of times the excuse is, oh, well, that's just, yeah, no one reads the footnotes anyway. Well, no, those are really important footnotes, because otherwise, especially with AI, you're gonna get things that are very, very misleading. You remember, I think we still do it on the senior Sunday here. Yeah, when the seniors graduate, we take like some of their baby pictures, and we kind of like spin it into what they look like now type of thing. Okay, don't tell them I call them a transitional form, but I'm just saying it's the same idea. You know, you're trying to just, you know, illustrate some way that this could turn into that. So that's basically what's going on. And so what you really want to try to do is get to the true science whenever possible. So one of the ones, and this one's still out there. Julie and I were out at a dinosaur. Well, I was out in Colorado, and it was south of Denver. There's some dinosaur trackways, and we went into one of the museums there, and it's just over the top, this people promoting the idea that dinosaurs turned into birds, because we know for all kinds of reasons dinosaurs didn't turn into birds, and it's everything from bone structure to turning scales into feathers to the respiratory system. And actually, what's interesting, if you go out to the Cook Museum over here in Decatur, it's like a 20-minute drive. It's actually very objective, because it points out like just the design features of a bird. It points out the design features of the solar system. They kind of tip the hand. They actually have a Bible verse at the end of the museum. So if you've never been out there, it's worth doing. But just going up, you go upstairs and you just look at all the design in a bird. So we know reptiles or dinosaurs didn't turn into birds, but they'll say things like, they get the little kids there, they'll ask the five-year-old, hey, did you eat a dinosaur this week? And of course, the five-year-old gets all excited. It's like, well, they'll eat no. And they'll say, oh no, did you have a chicken nugget? And they're like, well, yeah, of course, but five-year-old hadn't had a chicken nugget this week. And they say, well, you know, dinosaurs turned into chickens. And then the kid usually just gets totally lost and wanders off, which is good. But anyway, there was this idea that dinosaurs turned into birds. It was really being pushed, especially in the 90s. So this was Archaeoraptor, an Archaeoraptor that I think most people figured out is just a bird. But it was advertised as proof of dinosaur to bird evolution. So what happened was, basically a couple magazines, they went over to a region of China, and where you could find fossils, dinosaur fossils, and I guess this particular, but they were looking, they basically advertised it as paying $80,000 to anybody that could provide evidence that dinosaurs turned into birds. Okay, does anybody see what's non-scientific about that approach? Okay, yeah, exactly. So good people, but literally the equivalent wage in that area is like $1 a day. Okay, so $80,000, they're, you know. So unfortunately, some people were tempted. But anyway, they did get basically what's happening is the head and body of a bird. They were essentially putting a tail of a dinosaur, but in the vicinity, and you know, they tried different ways to make it look like, hey, everything's going to be found. It's kind of like Piltdown Man, where the bones were planted, so people would find it, and they could say that, oh, well, see, this went with this, and so you have the head and body of a bird and the tail of a dinosaur, that was the answer that was being looked for, and so they bought the fossils, put it on display. One of them was displayed in National Geographic's Explorer Hall from October 15th, 1999 to January 21st, 2000. 110,000 people saw it, because, yeah, it's a museum, a lot of you know, field trips, a lot of, I mean, good, you know, trying to educate the kids. So a lot of children saw it. Front page of the magazine, you know, it's Feathers for T-Rex, is admitted to be a fraud in January of 2000. Okay, and again, what had happened is just the body and head of a bird had been combined with the tail of a dinosaur, and then a similar fraudulent fossil was published in Nature a few months earlier. And you know, these are pretty well-known magazines. And so, now, the good news on this one is it was actually very well-publicized. This was Storrs Olson. He's a curator of birds at the National Museum of Natural History of the Smithsonian Institute of Washington, D.C. Literally, he could rightfully say he is the world's bird expert, okay? So he actually wrote a letter, and he said, the idea of feathered dinosaurs and the theropod origin of birds is being actively promulgated by a cadre of zealous scientists acting in concert with certain editors at Nature and National Geographic. He's also apparently high enough up that he could call them out by name. So anyway, it goes, Nature and National Geographic, who themselves have become outspoken and highly biased proselytizers of the faith. And of course, the faith was this idea of dinosaurs turned into birds. Truth and careful scientific weighing of evidence have been among the first casualties in the program, which is now fast becoming one of the grander scientific hoaxes of our age, the paleontological equivalent of cold fusion. Anybody remember cold fusion? All right, good. Okay, you're dating yourselves, but that's good. I remember it, so I'm with you. Okay, so cold fusion, it was it 87 or I can't remember. Anyway, this big splash about how we'd figured out how to make fusion work just by basically putting some deuterium into palladium wire, and you ran a current through the wire, and you're getting all this energy out. And everybody's like, wow, this is fantastic. And I was like, I'm always kind of a space nut. So I was working nuclear reactors at the time, and I'm like, well, I'm going to ditch those. This is way better, you know. And it lasted for 2 or 3 days. I was up in grad school at that time. They were actually, we took our whole hot fusion lab and we converted it basically into a cold fusion lab overnight. So all the hot fusion experiments, and so everybody had these little wires going up into this little pit, and you had those big concrete shielding, and they're down there trying to get this cold fusion work. Of course, no one could make it work again. And so it turned out it was just wrong. It wasn't ever working. I think it would have kept going, but what happened was the guys that were pushing the cold fusion, they were so confident. They said, hey, I know, why don't we take $75 million from the hot fusion budget and put it in the cold fusion budget? Okay, good. Okay, government employees are all laughing. Most of you figure out where that's going to go, right? I mean, it's kind of like, well, so anyway, they got shut down like an hour later. So when he says paleontological equivalent of cold fusion, he's just saying this is, yeah, got a lot of hype and a lot of people excited, but it's just nonsense. And so that was the, it even made USA Today. And I got to admit, this impressed me. It says, the missing link that wasn't bird fossils hailed as a major find until red-faced scientists discover it was doctored. Okay, so this one was pretty heavily retracted. The problem is like one of the magazines, its retraction was literally front page article, huge breakthrough. You know, we know dinosaurs turned into birds. Retraction was not on the front page. You know, the joke was, it's like the inner, I can't remember, I think it's inner left corner of page 16 is like the best place to put a retraction and keep it like 5 sentences long. You retracted it, but it's not something everybody's going to see. So anyway, but this one was very publicly acknowledged. Okay, that was a fraud. But again, you could have just gone back to the true science. I mean, and this is just picking on scales. Scales and feathers are totally different. I mean, scales are just folds of skin. Feathers are complex structures of barbed wire and hooks. Okay, so how do you turn a scale into a feather? Especially now what we know about DNA. I mean, how do you generate all of the totally different new information needed to turn a scale into a feather? Of course, no one can answer that. No source of new information. You can't really postulate even the more fit transitional forms, which also doesn't work. But then feather proteins are even different than scale proteins. And there's a lot of other differences you could get into. So just from true science, you know, dinosaurs didn't turn into birds, but we always, and there's still people out there pushing it. So it's, and if you have kids and school, just, you know, I would say literally even just take them out to the Cook Museum. I mean, the Creation Museum Ark and Counter are fantastic. Encourage anybody to go if you haven't been there, but it's that's a 6-hour drive. Cook Museum's like 20, 25 minute drive. So, you know, both make similar points. So now we'll spend the rest of the time talking about ape men, you know, this idea that apes turned into humans. That's also being rapidly refuted. And I have some pictures here towards the end. Uh, I took them probably around 2020. Apparently, they've actually improved even further. You know, just picture they took in the Smithsonian. But we'll get to those in a minute. But this was this all started probably in the early 1900s. Just this idea that maybe apes somehow turned into humans, and so it's kind of caught on. They had Piltdown Man, which was a fraud. That was 1915. That was one of the ones where they had a, I think it was a, like a human skull, and they stuck it like an ape jawbone kind of close by. That was a very deliberate. The one in China with the birds, that wasn't really a fraud. That was just people trying to earn a living. You know, I mean, that wasn't, yeah, well, okay, that's fraud. But anyway, it's a, but this was more of a deliberate, you know, placement of bones so other people would find it. I guess you'd say it that way. And so they, but by 1920s, yeah, it was starting to catch on pretty heavy, you know, as far as this idea of apes and humans. So there's all these different finds. Well, this was Nebraska, ma'am. What happened was they found a tooth in February 1992, as declared human by Dr. Henry F. Osborne, American Museum of Natural History in New York, and it made the cover story of the Illustrated London News in the June 24th of 2022. So I'll see if it probably doesn't show up on that. If you look at the picture there, let me, okay, so from a tooth, okay. Everybody sees Nebraska Man, right? Okay, so we know from a tooth, we know what Nebraska Man looks like. Okay, now we know what weapon he carried. See the club in his left hand, okay. We know what livestock he kept. You see the camels in the background, right? Okay, but does anybody see the most amazing thing of all? It's one tooth. We know what his wife looked like. Okay, so again, so this is more of a, it's not really a fraud, but it's just like, just, I mean, talk about subject to interpretation. And what was worse was in 1927, we found another tooth, but this time there were bones with it. And so it turns out Nebraska Man was not even a human, even though he was declared human. He was an extinct wild pig. But the pig was only extinct in Nebraska. They were actually still running around South America. Okay, so and so you think, okay, but that was cute. That was only for 5 years. People believed in Nebraska Man. Well, during that five-year period, 1925 was when we had the Scopes trial. So you see, you have this whole shift in people's, I guess you'd say, paradigm. This whole shift in what the U.S. was thinking about the idea of teaching evolution. Should we, at that point, it was just, well, should we be allowed to teach that apes turned into humans? And the whole Scopes trial is a whole different talk. It's interesting, but that was the whole idea, was to try to set it up. To say that, oh yeah, we should be allowed to, basically teach that apes turned into humans. Of course, now we're not to teach anything but that in a lot of the public schools, but at least at that time, that was a big deal. But it's all, this was just part of the atmosphere that was created to say, well, of course, yeah, how could anyone doubt this? I even heard about this Nebraska Man, and I even know what his wife looked like. I mean, it's just, so things like that actually do have a big effect. And so, what's happened now, this is all from, what I'm saying is this is, to me, it's really improving, and I want to just be honest, but this is probably from 30 or 40 years ago, and there were a lot of museums and zoos across the country that what they would do if they were trying to show this idea that apes turned into humans is they would essentially, it looked like they were just taking a mannequin. You know, like you go to a clothing store, you have a mannequin for like child's clothes, and you'd put a bunch of hair on it, and you'd take the child's head off, and you stick a monkey's head on it, and then you'd say, oh yeah, this is, whatever you want to call it. In this case, it'd been an Australopithecine. And so, but we had enough fossils. I mean, the fossils are limited. People still say, like, all the human fossils that have been found would easily fit in a single coffin. You know, and so in other words, it's limited. But we had foot bones. You know, we know what the shapes of the toes were, the fingers were, the hands were. And so it actually got so bad that it generated a response. So this is an associate professor of anatomy and neurobiology at Washington University. At that time, I think Washington University was the number two medical school in the U.S. Okay, so I mean, these are, high up people just kind of calling them out on this. So I'll read the quote in case. Apologize for the small print, but it says, the usual artistic license in reconstructing the fleshly features of ape men from bones allows evolutionary bias enormous free rein. However, artists do not usually misrepresent the bones. The statue's feet and hands are simply wrong and mislead the public. Minton cites evolutionary sources which showed that the creature and the species had hands and feet which were not at all like human hands and feet. Rather, they have long curved fingers and toes, even more so than apes today that live mostly in the trees. Okay, so this was a display, I'll call it 40 years ago. And of course you have the, you know, the ape's head on the human body, lots of hair. Says a Canadian school teacher, David Buckner, has weighed in on the debate by posting an internet challenge to this misleading statue. He says that if the people visiting this exhibition were to see an accurate replica of Lucy in the trees, which features typical of tree-dwelling primates, it would make them question the whole notion of human evolution. Lucy would be seen as just some sort of extinct ape. Bruce Carr, the zoo's director of education, has no plans to alter the exhibit. We cannot be updating every exhibit based on every new piece of evidence, he says. Okay, what we look at is the overall exhibit and the impression it creates. We think that the overall impression this exhibit creates is correct. And so this is, you know, again, if you, you know, you'll be in certain museums at zoos and other places, it's religious. I mean, I don't know how else to phrase it. Yeah, I mean, cause that's a very, obviously that's a very religious statement. Again, anybody here that's worked for the government, no, you never say you can't do something, you just tell them you need this much money. You know, so it's, you know, and so, but you know, he doesn't want to update it, and he knows it's wrong, and it wasn't even updated, it wasn't new evidence, the evidence has always been there, but it's just, again, just pushing this idea, the overall impression. You know, the impression is, you know, gives us impression that things evolved, so they want to, you push that. And I'll give another spoiler, it actually turns out, I've heard, and I haven't been up there yet, if anybody happens to go up to D.C. and you go into the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, it's a multi-hundred million dollar exhibit promoting evolution. Apparently they just updated it, so now they have Lucy dwelling in the trees. Okay, and that's what I mean by it's getting better. So 40 years ago, you know, like various places weren't changing things. The evidence is so overwhelming that Lucy was just an ape, that they're apparently, and I haven't been there, so I haven't been there in like 5 years. So I'm gonna try to find an excuse to get up there, just get some pictures and stuff. But it's but they made a couple incremental improvements since then. But again, it's a lot of people grew up hearing that apes turned into humans and Lucy somehow was an ape that turned into a human. This is a replica. It's up at the Creation Museum, but that's just trying to be really objective. What's a reasonable interpretation based on the bones, not altering the pelvis, not altering the hands and the feet, is that Lucy would look like what you see in that upper right-hand corner. And again, a really, really cool ape. You'd love to go see one of those. I think they're all extinct, but it's certainly not gonna leave you with the impression, because you know, again, we're talking about the impression in the exhibit. Well, if we're looking for an impression, that doesn't convince me apes turned into humans. That's just like, wow, there were some really cool apes. You know, and so that's, it goes on and says, Dr. Menton points out that if Lucy's feet were accurately shown, it would be obvious they could never fit into the famous Laetoli fossil footprints. These exhibit A for evolutionary belief in upright walking by Lucy's kind, whereas in fact they're identical to barefoot humans. Professor Betsy Schumann, evolutionist expert at Menton's University, admits that statue's feet probably are not accurate, but when asked whether the statue should be changed, she says, absolutely not. And so again, it's just really odd. But again, the good news is this was probably 40 years ago, and it's the situation appearing. There's some really good videos out there. So this was, again, from the Smithsonian maybe 5 years ago. And so this was one of the displays. And the quote, though, it says, okay, the brown bones are cast of the parts of Lucy's skeleton that were excavated. The black bones represent missing parts. Okay, so that's good. You know, they're acknowledging that, hey, there's a lot of parts that weren't found. Yeah, and so like that was an improvement, you know, because it's not, because you notice there's the brown is kind of, you know, outweighed by the black there, you know, so, but they're fine parts. It says they were filled in using myriad images of bones that were found. Okay, if I was trying to reconstruct something on limited evidence, that makes sense. God tended to design things to have, you know, mirror images, you know, left hand, right hand, symmetry. And it says, they were filled in using mirror images of bones that were found, fossils from other individuals of Lucy's species, and knowledge of human anatomy. Okay, so when you're using your knowledge of human anatomy, what are you assuming? Well, you're assuming that Lucy is turning into a human, right? Why didn't you use knowledge of chimp anatomy? So two ways that played out, it was, I think it was 1997, there's actually a really good PBS document, it's probably available on YouTube. I'm pretty sure it's, the video is still available on YouTube. And it has this whole, it's very, you know, very pro-evolution, but it's this whole documentary about how, well, maybe Lucy turned into humans. And a lot of the stuff in there has been, I talk like angle of the knees, and if you look at all the evidence, it's very selective what evidence presented. It's totally in the range of, chimps and apes. But also, a part of that move, that video, they literally show, I think Lovejoy was the one doing it, and I'll mention names if it wasn't, you can watch the video, literally saying, well, the pelvis doesn't look right, and so he assumed that the animal had died, a deer must have stepped on the pelvis, it rearranged the bone so it looked like a chimp pelvis, of all things, an ape pelvis, not a human pelvis, and so he reconstructed it in a way to try to make it look human. And so that's part of that knowledge of human anatomy. And it's one of those ones, it's him being interviewed live before deep fakes were a thing. And it's still on YouTube, it's about 1997. I'll try to get you guys a link later on, but yeah.
So I have a question. When they say an ape evolves into a human, wouldn't logic say that there shouldn't be any apes around anymore?
Yeah, there, it's all, that would be very consistent.
Say that they can defend that there's still monkeys running around.
Yeah, it's always like a just so story. And so think about, and I've never read the books, but I've heard like Harry Potter books are very internally consistent, okay? And so what they'll do is they'll, it's all fake, by the way. I'm guessing everybody here knows that. Okay, I don't want to be a spoiler. Okay, so it's all fake. Star Wars kind of holds together, all fake. And so, but it's almost like, well, that must just be that way. Because you're right, it doesn't, there's all kinds of things that they'll, I think it was another documentary around that time where you had the very, I'll just say, likable grad student saying that, well, yeah, from everything we know, it's impossible for life to make itself, but we know it happened once. Yeah, and it's just, because obviously we're here, so we must have evolved, So that stuff is just allowed to slide, and it's, but no, you're right. I mean, there's all kinds of logical fallacies. How would you get the transitional forms? You start looking at selection pressure. You start looking at how do you, shift, these huge shifts, especially the dinosaur to birds one's just ridiculous as far as the whole huge shifts in anatomy, but even the ape to human, just the physical changes needed for an ape turning human to go from, tree dwelling to upright walking. It's just there's no credible way for that to happen.
Mike.
Yeah.
What do they think they gain by taking this position?
I don't know. I actually don't know. I mean, I have to look at
the
people that paid for that exhibit. There was these very humanistic families, and they were very rich, and somehow, but how they got to the point of having that much control, I don't know. It's the early 1970s, was it the Humanist Manifesto take over the educational system? And I glanced at it once and I couldn't bring myself to read it again, so I'm sure other people here might be more familiar with it. But because they ought to realize that they're, if you deny God, you're basically saying, I want to spend eternity separated from God. And if anybody thinks that's a gain, that's just weird. I mean, sorry, I know not to use words like that, but it's just, I really have no idea. There's not really a huge, I can't see any real financial benefit for that, but it's kind of where we're at now.
Sounds like a massive downgrade. I mean, to say that humans evolved from apes, usually through the evolution process, it seems like things would downgrade, not upgrade.
Yeah, and they do. Yeah, they devolve, and that's the losing information from the genome, losing fitness. We'll talk about that. Probably won't get to that this week, but sometimes. So, yeah. It's kind of like, I think we had some really good discussion about, why do people deny God? Why won't they objectively consider Christianity? It's different for every person. But I guess when I was growing up, I was very staunch evolutionist, and I never really thought about it. And that's all I'd ever been taught. And if someone tries to tell you something that you've been taught since you're 2 years old is wrong, then you just naturally, you're like, oh no, it's common sense. We all know evolution works, And so it's hard to change. And so that's another one. I would just say, I think a lot of the people, and then they don't think about it. Now you ask them, are they actually, a lot of the people that are really doing the leading edge research, they think evolution is a waste of time because they're just looking at what's there and how it works and trying to figure out. Biomimicry is a huge thing now, and so they to them it doesn't matter if that's but how God designed something, or wow, nature sure did a wonderful job with the last 3.8 billion years. You know, it doesn't, another marketing department might tell them, well, yeah, stick with the nature because you don't want to offend anybody. But they're just looking, yeah, because you have everything from the, you've probably heard like the shark skin paint, and the, we now have this paint that's actually a little bit rough that you put on the hulls of ships because it actually makes them have less drag. Well, that went against every assumption we ever had. And so we're looking at these poor unevolved sharks because they still got some roughness on their skin, and we figure out they're like 40% more efficient because of it, swimming. And then the, is it the humpback whales that have little knobs on the front of their fins? Poor things, they haven't evolved quite yet. And we start figuring out that, they're the same ones that can do this and basically get shrimp in the middle, and one of them swims up and eats all the shrimp. And so then we start figuring out that, wow, that actually makes them really, really maneuverable. So we start putting them on airplanes. Okay, so that's biomimicry, and it just goes across the board. But again, if someone goes up outside the church, they've never thought of God, but they'll just think, wow, I can learn so much from nature. And so that's a way we can use this to evangelize, is if you run into something like that, and there's a lot of them in town here, just point out at some point how you can introduce, well, do you really think that just made itself? And you can look at anything in the human body, even down to the just ATP production. I mean, anything. And you really just get someone to think, do you really think that could just evolve? If they're being objective, they're gonna say no. Now, if they're, for whatever reason, they hate Christians, that goes back to what we were talking about at the start, speak the truth in love. If they just decide, no, I'm gonna oppose Christianity no matter what, then they'll just make stuff up. I don't know why there's still this, but it's here, so it must be evolution. So that's, I guess, the other key is why it's so important to speak the truth in love, is to keep them from just having this reason where no matter what the evidence, they're gonna reject Christianity. And that's, unfortunately, that's what it looks like happened with like Francis Crick, with Fred Hoyle, because they knew. I mean, it's, so I didn't really answer the question, but it's,
It's a curiosity to me what you gain when you eliminate God.
Well, you gain the ability to spend eternity separated from God. So that's a, yeah.
I thought maybe this comes out of the idea of, okay, so where did God come from?
Yeah, but that's an easy one these days, because in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, so he had to create the dimension of time.
But
in the beginning, so he creates the dimension of time.
Yep.
And so to create the dimension of time, he has to be outside of time. And by definition, anything outside the dimension of time can't have a beginning or an end. And it takes a little while to think about that, but if it's outside the dimension of time, before doesn't make any sense, after doesn't make any sense, beginning doesn't make any sense, end doesn't make any sense, because those all require time. And the only reason I say now is because, we'll talk more about the Big Bang in a couple weeks too, is all of these theories basically have to appeal to the supernatural. So, because they always talk about, a point of infinite density when the laws of nature don't apply, or they'll talk about a universe that's generated an infinite number of universes outside. Well, they're all supernatural, but they all also have to exist outside of time. So they will say that, but that is one. You'll get asked that very sincerely by a lot of people, so I don't want to downplay it. And so, especially if it's like a five-year-old, or four, because they're going to ask you that. Okay, if God made everything, who made God? Boy, just drop everything. Even if you burn dinner, I wouldn't say wreck the car, but you know what I mean. Pull over to the side. Drop everything and answer that question, because that is very serious. And just say, God created everything, including time. And then at some point, they're going to totally lose you, but they'll just realize that this wise adult that was talking to me explained that, because God also created time, he's outside of time, and he can't have a beginning or an end, and then they'll probably ask you, so he doesn't set a timer for bedtime, or I don't know, whatever. So it's, but take those questions very seriously. So I never want to downplay any question at all, but that's, and so they'll ask that, and then it's, it just goes back to, and again, rumor was Francis Crick, literally, he's on his deathbed trying to figure out some way at all that even a tiny bit of DNA could somehow make itself, and he concluded that it couldn't. So,
Now that we've mapped the human genome and have DNA, are any of these people going back and taking these bones and showing that DNA does not match human DNA? Is anybody?
Yes. So they realize it doesn't, but then and that's why they come up with these strange ages. So they assume that you have these DNA differences, and like in the chimps, the Y chromosome, the difference between chimps and humans is greater than the rest of the genome. And it should be, the measured rate is much less. In other words, it changes much more slowly. So it's exact opposite of what evolution would predict. But they'll also look at parts of the genome and they'll say, well, okay, if say we all had this common ape-like ancestor X number of years ago, then, they just assume a certain mutation rate. They don't say why those mutations would happen, but just assume a certain mutation rate to get to where we are now.
Is there anybody, Christians, championing truth on trying to get?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, a lot of them.
And Trump is Trump's thing with the Smithsonian. Is that about the?
I haven't followed that.
So that been protesting all of the exhibits and the.
Yeah, I haven't been tracking that one, but if someone gets up to the, if you do get up to the Smithsonian, and you get some pictures, I'll show you the. We'll go through these. These are the two best things because they just started updating the exhibit. This is probably like 5 years ago, and then it gets really bad after this. So we'll start up here next week because I sometimes try to wait for the third bell, but then someone told me there isn't one. So but thanks a lot. Let's close with a prayer, and then we'll. Heavenly Father, just thank you again for all the blessings you give us and the opportunities that we have to be together in the fellowship and to just learn more about your creation and your word and your will for our life. Please be with us all this week and keep us safe spiritually and physically. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.